Well, let's see where we'll start, I guess. Chapter 6. It's dawned to me that I guess among the homework that you're just handing in, I guess, there was something explicitly about cardinal arithmetic in general. So let me once more refer to cardinal arithmetic. I guess I went through some examples from analysis involving cardinal arithmetic. But in cardinal arithmetic in general, again, the basic fact is for kappa and infinite cardinal, kappa times kappa, the cardinality of that product equals kappa. We essentially did a proof of that, but I didn't bother to emphasize that it happened. So basically, the proof is basically just like proving omega times omega equals omega, exactly like the countable thing. And in fact, I phrased the proof of that in that way. You have a kappa times kappa, so that for each gamma less than kappa, the set gamma cross gamma, and I know you know what that is, but I'll just say it, all those pairs. Actually, let me do it as gamma plus, such that pairs alpha, beta, less than or equal to gamma, is an initial segment. You can order, and in fact, that's a well ordering. You know, again, the quick reminder about that, i.e., at x sub gamma be the set of things that have that max, the set of alpha beta such that the max of alpha beta equals gamma, and order each x gamma. I won't bother to repeat it, but it's, a copy of gamma, another copy of gamma, and then one point. Right here, the pair gamma-gamma goes. Right here, the alpha-gamma goes. Right here, the gamma-beta goes. And that's the well ordering. And then order each as chunks by the ordering on the set of gamma that are less than kappa. And that will give you a well ordering. The important part is that because of the very way we're ordering it, the pairs whose max is less than or equal to gamma, namely this set of things, simply comes first, and then those with bigger maxes come after. So this is an initial segment. And then you basically do, you prove that kappa times kappa equals kappa by induction. The quickest way to simply refer to that would be, i.e., by way of contradiction, assume there is a kappa infinite cardinal such that kappa times kappa does not equal kappa. Take the least, so for all gamma less than kappa, either gamma is finite, and so gamma cross gamma is finite, or the cardinality of gamma cross gamma equals the cardinality of gamma. Because the cardinality of gamma is the cardinal less than kappa for which the leastness of kappa, taking the least kappa, that would apply, right? So here we well ordered this, say, by, let's call it, fancy looking less than, right? The epsilon image of the well ordering kappa cross kappa with less than is, i.e., the unique ordinal such that segments are less than kappa, and yet it's of size kappa, which I didn't have room to write down. So that's basically the argument I sketched for the case of omega. We wrote down something in order, you know, that thing where you wander through pairs, and each initial part is finite, and the whole thing was infinite, so it's got to be of order type the same as omega. Its epsilon image has to be omega. That's the argument for this type of thing. So you saw it used for omega, but it's true in general. And I do apologize, you know, you did have some homework at the end about this stuff. But let me just say some things about it. So here's our proof. The consequences for cardinal arithmetic, if, mu is less than or equal to kappa, are cardinals, and kappa is infinite, then mu plus kappa equals kappa. And given this, we can just do proofs pretty easily. We have clearly kappa is less than or equal to 0 plus kappa, less than or equal to mu plus kappa, less than or equal to kappa plus kappa. That's 2 times kappa, but kappa is infinite, so it's bigger than all finite cardinals. That's less than or equal to kappa kappa. We're really climbing up, and if we were in the finite, best we could do is now with estimates, but it all collapses. So, and that's just kappa. And essentially the same kind of argument here. If in addition, if mu does not equal 0, mu times kappa also equals kappa. Proof. Let's see, we want kappa equals 1 times kappa is less than or equal to mu times kappa. So we got a lower bound. And mu times kappa is less than or equal to mu's less than or equal to kappa. So there's our kappa times kappa again equals kappa. Right. So putting things together in this way, taking unions of sets, taking products, you're not going to get out of the maximal cardinality being mentioned. Some examples of cardinal calculations here then would be, let's do the following type of problem for A, an infinite set of some cardinality, infinite cardinality kappa. For example, look at, let's call it script E, the set of equivalency relations on A. Let's say E is an equivalence relation. Then we can do a cardinal calculation on this. The cardinality of E equals 2 to the kappa. So this is kind of argument. It's just a question of taking enough examples to see that we build up to the size being, you know, that we're claiming. One direction typically is going to be easy. I mean, after all, E is a subset of the power set of A cross A. So the cardinality of E then is less than or equal to 2 to the kappa times kappa. And again, with the cardinal arithmetic thing that we have, it all collapses. That's just 2 to the kappa. So we just need a lower estimate. So we just need a 1-1 map from, say, kappa to 2, two script E. We just need enough equivalence relations. So one way to do this, that we need this, one way. Well, typically for the kind of thing we're doing, it's usually pretty easy to think of what really should be lots and lots of instances, which is what a 1-1 map is claiming to have. 1-1 means there's just many things there. The only issue is making sure that when you write down the proposed many things, they really are all distinct. And quite often that simply comes down to having enough room in terms of where you're working. So, for example, kappa equals kappa plus 1. Kappa equals the cardinality of A. So from this, so, you know, A can be written as B union, say, C. C not in B, where cardinality of B is also kappa. And it's just a way of making sure that we have enough room. So now, what would this translate into for each x contained in B? Again, that has cardinality kappa. Cardinality is kappa, so there's lots of there's this many of those x's. Let, for example, E sub x be the equivalence relation on A that says, oh, say, for B in X, the equivalence class of B is just singleton B, and otherwise the other equivalence, oops, let's see, maybe I needed more things here. Any X subset, maybe I need two more things here. So let me write it like this. A equals B plus two more things. C and D, not in B, C not equal to D. Kappa equals kappa plus two. So a set of size kappa is of the form a set of size kappa plus two more elements. So that might give me enough room for what I want. Again, the thing I was saying before, I'm just trying to do something where I do get a 1-1 map. For each X, I'm producing a equivalence relation, and different ones will pop out. So I'm describing for X a subset of B, an equivalence relation will make, for B and X, it itself, singleton B, will be an equivalence class. Otherwise, the other equivalence class is A minus X. So member of X, equivalence class is just it, and all the other things are considered equivalent. Okay? And the only reason for doing this or actually saying anything about it is that, so notice for X, Y contained in B, X not equal to Y implies E sub X is not equal to E sub Y. You can read off what X was from E sub X, i.e., for E such that E equals E sub X for some X, you can figure out what X is. X is simply the set of B such that singleton B equals the equivalence class for it. That's the way we built these things. X was supposed to be the one such that that, and again, maybe I lost heart too early here, but I definitely had enough elements here to make sure the other equivalence class won't have just have one element. So it can't be confused by the ones that do. So that guarantees this, i.e., the map X goes to E sub X, which takes us from the power set of B to script E is 1-1. The map here is 1-1. And that's what we said we wanted. We need a 1-1 map from something of this size, and that's equal to the cardinality of the power set of B. B has cardinality kappa, so there's this has cardinality the same as that. So use this as an example of it. There's something pretty simple-minded about this one, but precisely the same idea would work for something where you might feel you have your hands a bit more tied. For example, suppose we ask a slightly more refined question that's being asked just to make sure this method doesn't work, right? So this method, for subsets of B, we produce lots of equivalence relations by looking at the classes, the B's who, such as singleton B, was an equivalence class. So let's just get rid of those. So example continued. Let's let E sub 0, say, equal the set of E contained in A cross A, such that E's in a Coombs relation. And let me just try to tie my hands here some way. So say all equivalence classes have size exactly 2. So I can't play any games on which equivalence classes just have one element, or even which ones have 2, and so on. But still, the thing really happening here is that we simply had a way, given 2 to the cap of many things, like these x's, for producing different things. And there's plenty of room to produce things in this situation. So again, like I said here, this was just one way to do this. There's usually many ways to do it. One way to do this one, let's say, kappa is actually equal to 4 times kappa, right? By our cardinal arithmetic, this is cardinal to that is the max of 4 and kappa, hence kappa. We can have maybe A itself won't be it. So A is equinumerous to B cross, say, 4 things. My favorite set of size 4 is a 4 itself, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, is where B has cardinality kappa. And having 4 elements gives me plenty of leeway to decide on certain things being size 2 of Coombs classes or not. If I write this as E0 of A, right? So E0 of A is equinumerous with E0 of this set because the two sets are equinumerous. And this is by qual problem 1. This could be a qual problem, for example. You got a bijection between the set A and whatever you want to call this set. You build a Coombs relation of certain forms over one. You just build them over the other one, too. So we might as well just deal here. The set 0, 1, 2, 3 has, in fact, it doesn't really matter, but it actually turns out to have exactly 3 equivalence relations where the equivalence classes all have size 2. I mean, we could have 0, 1, 2, 3, or 0, 2, 1, 3, 1, 3, or 0, 3, 1, 2, as a way of indicating what the equivalence classes are for the equivalence relation. So we have equivalence relation, say, let's call it E1. Here we have E2, and here we have E3. And these are all on the set with 4 elements. And that gives us a way to choose which equivalence relation to pick, and hence see that we have lots of possibilities here, and hence we can count them. Again, where are we here? This is the same way. I hope it's clear. As before, I should have said this, I guess, before. But as before, E0 of say A is a subset of the power set of A cross A. So the cardinality in question, cardinality of E0 of A, is less than or equal to 2 to the kappa times kappa, which is 2 to the kappa. To show cardinality of E0 of A is at least 2 to the kappa, it's enough to show the cardinality of E0 of B cross 0, 1, 2, 3 is greater or equal to 2 kappa because these are equinumerous. And now we're set up finally to use exactly the same ideas here. for x contained in B, let E sub x be the equivalence relation such that we have that, you know, A, well, equivalence relation on what? This thing, B cross 0, 1, 2, 3, where what are elements here? They're things of the form AN, and or let's say BN and CM, where B, C are in B, and NM are, well, you know, 0 is less than or equal to NM is strictly less than 4, right? So we'll have these be equivalent if and only if B equals C, and well, it's going to depend on the x. And if B is an x, then we'll use, say, then we use E1. We want N to be E1 equivalent to M. If B is not an x, then use E2, say, and we want N to be E2 equivalent to M. So if E equals E sub x for some x, then we can, then E tells us what x is, i.e., I'm basically describing the inverse map here, namely, what is x? Just read it off from this. X will be the set of B in B, such that if I, for N, M, you know, like that, N, shoot, how do you say this thing? B, BN is E equivalent to BM if and only if N is E, which one did I pick? E1 equivalent to M. So given an x, we had a way to make decisions about which equivalence relation to use that was specific to whether something was an x or not. And so that means the thing we produce, even if I forget what x is and just look at the object itself, the equivalence relation, it tells us what x is. X equals this thing, as you can see. For B is not an x, it won't equal, B not an x, it won't be in this set because it's not going to be the E1 equivalence relation here, it'll be the E2 one. Okay, so so we have a map from, what are we taking? Power set of B, x is in there, goes to E sub x. So it's a map from power set of B to E of B cross, well, it's really just B cross 4. So we have this map, and it's 1, 1. That's what this argument says. If you want, we could call this x sub e. It's 1, 1, so, you know, i.e., for all x, x equals x sub e sub x. We produced an inverse function. E goes to, sorry, which one? E goes to x sub e is the inverse function. And again, making it 1-1 is enough to complete our cardinality calculation. We want to show that this is at least that. We have that this set, B cross 4, has a 1-1 map from the power set of B, and cardinality of the power set of B equals, this thing has cardinality kappa, so that's equal to 2 to the kappa. So we challenge 2 to the kappa is less than. Okay, so this is the kind of arguments you can do for figuring out the sizes of various sets that could be built, you know, starting with a set of any size. And hence it's kind of understanding what the cardinality is of sets like these, if you want. Okay, let's see. You have some debts, as the text, you know, describes it too, accumulated in the course of this. The main, chapter 6 has been presented in class. So that the main debt was simply was at the start we asserted that for all sets A there is an ordinal alpha such that A is equinumerous with alpha. I kind of owe that debt. The easiest way to do that debt, by the way, is by doing the thing that I've been circling around with something called transfinite recursion, which is in chapter 7. But you know, considering where we are, I might as well just point out the I guess that is the easiest way. So let's say either that or do we learn lemma, right? So okay. So to prove this, we will use what's called finite recursion. And so, and you know, and this is from Chapter 7. And let me try to present that in terms of actually seeing how the proof works of this type of thing. It's the most streamlined way to do it, but it will be pushing something that I'd like to push. So I'd like to actually do finite recursion on all the ordinals. So the situation that we want to be in here then, so we will be talking about a class, namely the ordinals, and operations. We've already remarked, so I'll make it again. Remark, we may always assume an operation O is defined at all x, i.e., if not, replace O by O star, where, say, O star of X is simply what O of X said if O of X is defined and equals some default, say, the null set if O of X is not defined. And now we have an operation which does exactly what the original operation did, but is operating on everything. The situation for transfinite recursion is that we simply want to iterate an operation through the ordinals. So the transfinite recursion it's not clear what to call this. In some sense, technically, it's a whole bunch of theorems. They all have exactly the same proof. But since an operation is just a manner of speaking, for each manner of speaking, you plug in it to the form of the proof to get the appropriate one. And in the course of the proof, we'll use various axioms, like maybe subset axioms or replacement axioms. And you'll just plug in the appropriate instance of it using the manner of speaking that the operation O is. So the transformer for, you know, for O an operation such that O of X is defined for all sets X, say, there is an operation, another manner of speaking, call it H, such that for all ordinals, alpha is defined, and we can say exactly what it is. H of alpha is obtained in the following way. Since we're assuming that H of alpha is defined for all ordinals alpha, it's also defined at all ordinals less than alpha, so we can take the restriction and simply apply the operation to it. So that, in a nutshell, is all that we want to really be going on when we do a recursion. We have a way to continue, and if so, just to parse this for us, so you know, notice H is defined for all ones, so for each alpha, for all beta less than alpha, H H at beta is defined. So we have a function at each beta, for beta less than alpha, we have that value. So in terms of the way of building function notation, it would be this way. So we have a function, the domain is alpha. Before saying something about the proof, let me point out the way in which the axioms of set theory are going to be used. Crucial to this whole thing is that this thing here, it's crucial here, that this object, H restricted to alpha, is not a manner of speaking. And how should I say that? It's crucial that it's not just a manner of speaking. It is a manner of speaking. H is some way, so we can say what the values are somehow. That's the whole point of the theorem, to be able to say it. And so we are saying this thing, but so we when we say we have a function, that's you know, an object, a set. It's really there. We describe it, and so on. And so I want to linger for a moment before saying things about how this is proved, about the way the axioms could be used to produce that object. You should notice so the axiom of replacement, or actually it's the axioms of replacement, just like the subset axioms, basically simply say for an operation, say O, and a set A, such that O of little a is defined for all A and A, then, well, I'll phrase it this way, because in the context, it's the easier way to say it. Then this thing exists, is a set. So if you have an operation, you can produce that thing. And so in some sense, right here, in the above, the replacement axioms are used. But if, referring back over to here, you know, if we are doing a recursion where we already have a set, say B, such that the operation O of X is always defined and always in B, then you don't need the replacement axiom to assert this. You know, then H restricted to alpha, the point I'm talking about here, H of beta is defined. I don't know if I actually said it clearly here. I'm referring to this H restricted to alpha. So H restricted to alpha is the function domain alpha for beta in alpha. It gives out the value H at beta. So this is what I'm referring to by H restricted to alpha there. If we're in a situation where we already have the set where all the values are going to appear, then H restricted alpha, it can be seen to be a set. A set using the subset axioms. After all, what is it? H restricted to alpha is a, even as a manner of speaking, is a subclass of what? Domain is alpha. And its values are inside B, so it's a subclass of that. This thing being, again, if to write it out, the set of pairs, beta, H of beta, such that beta is in alpha. So beta's inside alpha, check. And this thing, by assumption, this is in B. So we have a set already. B is a set. Alpha is an ordinal, so it's a set. Product produces a set. It's a subclass of that. So H restricted to alpha is a set via a subset axiom. So for some point of view, it's not a particularly big thing. But when we actually try to get a feeling for the totality of the axioms as the course proceeds toward the end, it will turn out to be useful to try to see that we could keep track of the uses of the replacement axioms. Like, we've hardly used them at all. We did use them to get epsilon images, and so that can be commented on at the appropriate point. We are going to be using it to prove transfinite recursion as stated in this way, but only if we're really being ambitious. If we already know a target set for what the operation H is going to be producing values in, we're not using the replacement axiom. We're just using the subset axioms. Okay. So how about, is there any time to prove this? Proof. So as you can see, though, it's a particularly streamlined statement. The key thing to the proof is, in fact, the thing pointed out here about what's essential to actually even give any hope to this, that we don't get tongue-tied trying to say what this object is. It's an object we can just point to. So proof, the important thing is simply the uniqueness. So let's do a definition for alpha and ordinal. And if you look at some proofs of recursion for omega, we're going to be doing something that hopefully might feel a little familiar. For an ordinal alpha, the issue about everything is, what is this function? So let's give a definition about what it is. For an ordinal alpha, a function f with domain alpha is acceptable. And maybe I want to say alpha acceptable, to emphasize that I'm talking about alpha, if and only if Well, I'd like to say it's this thing, but of course the whole point of this is to actually, what's the content of the theorem? There is, but it's not an object. It's an operation. All that's being said here is that, so i.e., we can say this somehow. The only content of the thing is our ability to actually say what we're talking about. The way the thing is phrased in terms of referring to pointing to something, which when you unravel it is, someone's claiming to be able to say this. So let's try to say it. The key thing is, what are these guys? So, definition, a function with domain alpha is acceptable if and only if, we just look at what we have, if and only if, for all beta less than alpha, f at beta is exactly what we wanted here. The operation applied to the earlier stuff. We don't get tongue-tied trying to actually say at the moment the thing we're claiming to be able to say. We assume we actually have it as an object and refer to it. So notice one of the difficulties with doing the transfinite recursion is the fact that somehow you seem to end up saying everything at least twice, if not three times, and sometimes, I don't know, even more. Because obviously, to say this, so also h of beta is the operation of h restricted to beta, which is the motivation behind this. So we've defined the notion of a acceptable function. One thing I didn't bother to put into the statement of the theorem, but I'll do it right now in the proof, is the uniqueness. A claim for each alpha, there is at most one acceptable function. Oh, proof. Suppose there were two. If f, g, both have domain equal to alpha, and both are acceptable, then by way of contradiction, assume f does not equal g. So there is a beta less than alpha, such that f of beta does not equal g of beta, but these are ordinals. Alpha is an ordinal. So take the least such beta. So for gamma less than beta, f of gamma equals g of gamma, i.e., this is true for all the gammas less than beta. So f restricted to beta equals g restricted to beta. Thus, f at beta, we're doing a recursion, so its value is coming in a predictable way from its previous values, but the whole function of previous values is identical to the ones for g, and that's g of beta. And we've contradicted our assumption. Again, the justification for these things is, clearly, here, we're just referring to the equality there. And here, we're just saying that f's acceptable. And here, we're just saying g's acceptable. Okay, so, you can only have one acceptable function. They just automatically have to agree by the fact that they're being defined by a recursion. You can't get a disagreement at beta without having a disagreement earlier, just by the very way it's being done. So that's the uniqueness. But uniqueness gives us sayability. So we can now say the operation for alpha an ordinal, let f sub alpha equal the unique acceptable function with domain alpha if it exists. Notice by uniqueness, if F alpha exists and say gamma is less than alpha, then F alpha restricted to gamma, which obviously also exists, is acceptable to gamma. To really prove that, I just have to write down the definition of acceptable again. But if gamma exists, acceptable to gamma just means for all beta less than gamma, F alpha restricted to gamma at beta equals our operation applied to F alpha restricted to gamma restricted to beta. But this thing here, to take F alpha restricting it to a somewhat big domain and then restrict it to a slightly smaller one, is simply F alpha restricted to beta. So that's what this says, but so is acceptable. So i.e., we see to see this, which is what acceptable to gamma means, it's the same as, but F alpha is acceptable. And that's simply the statement for all beta less than alpha. F alpha at beta equals the operation applied to F alpha restricted to beta. And so you can see that this is just this statement, but instead of saying it for all beta less than alpha, we say for all beta less than gamma. So this thing is acceptable. So if you actually had an acceptable thing, it propagates downward and produces the lower acceptable things, right? So, and then that actually tells us what these acceptable functions are. So, if F alpha exists, then for all beta less than alpha, F alpha of beta actually equals F beta of, the operation O applied to F beta, because F alpha acceptable tells us F alpha of beta equals O of F alpha restricted to beta, and that equals F beta. So now we have a way to say what our operation is. So we define H by alpha, H of alpha is defined if and only if F alpha exists, in which case H alpha equals the operation applied to F alpha, just as we're seeing for all these acceptable functions, how they do it. So, and here, this is the actual content of what's being said here. We can actually say this. Here we're asserting the existence of something, which is just a manner of speaking. So we can't just say it exists and has these properties. We have to say what it is. By just referring to the actual objects that exist, we can. We define H alpha by referring to the, if it exists, unique thing, saying, making this defined only when it does exist, and then doing what is the only thing to do there, namely this. So we've defined H. What else do we have to do? So to show that this works, to see that H works, well, we're just trying to show something. So basically, by induction on ordinals, I'll again do it by the hand method of just referring to the well ordering behind what's going on. So if H alpha is not, if there is an ordinal alpha such that f alpha is not defined, or if h alpha is defined but does not equal the operation applied to the restriction, then if there is an ordinal with some property, then we can take the least one. Let alpha be the least such. So, for beta less than alpha, h beta is defined, and h beta equals the operation applied to h restricted to beta. What's that mean, though? H beta equals the operation applied to f beta. The fact that it's defined just means f beta exists. So the operation simply defined to f beta, and that means that, in fact, so h restricted, it's defined for all the betas less than alpha, so h restricted to alpha is an alpha acceptable function. So f alpha does exist. So there it does, and it's unique, and we simply define h beta to be it. H f alpha does exist, and so h of alpha is defined, and by definition of h, h alpha equals O of f alpha, but f alpha turned out to be h restricted to alpha, so h of alpha equals O of h restricted to alpha. And that's basically all we've been claiming here. So a certain manner of speaking, because the axioms of set theory say that the crucial things involved in all this stuff, these restrictions actually are going to exist, if, you know, or and the fact that it's on something well ordered, the ordinals, means that there's nothing preventing them from exist. And we don't have to actually apply the axioms by hand one after the other through the transfinite. They're somehow magically being applied by one instance, because we just apply it to kind of, you know, all the ordinals by one instance of either a subset axiom or replacement axiom, depending which one. Anyway, so this is the proof of transfinite recursion. I'll try to use it next time to, you know, do the stuff we owe from chapter 6. Okay, thanks.